Well, we're back. Howard Schwartz will read first. Howard Schwartz, for those of you who don't know him, has been a virtual library of Alexandria unto himself. He's, over the last 30 years, devoted himself, first of all, as a poet, to working with themes and concepts largely from the Jewish literary tradition. He's also worked as a folklorist, bringing over into translation and into English and into books, often for the first time, a rich mine of Jewish folkloric literatures in a series of anthologies. These have included books called Miriam's Tambourine, which was a collection of Jewish folk tales from around the world, Lilith's Cave, which focused on Jewish tales of the supernatural, and Elijah's Violin and other Jewish fairy tales. He's currently working on a book of essays that'll discuss this whole tradition. And he's also edited a wonderful collection of modern parables called Invisible Messages, a collection of contemporary Jewish poets called Voices Within the Ark, the Modern Jewish Poets. And with all that, he's had time to develop quite a body of his own work of poetry and fiction. Tonight he'll be reading poetry at the Duff's Poetry Series. His collections of poetry are called Vessels, Gathering the Sparks, and Sleeping Beneath the Stars, three titles. He's also published two prose books, The Four Who Entered Paradise, a kind of creative explication of one of the famous mystical tales in the Jewish literary tradition, and The Captive Soul of the Messiah. Howard has been teaching most of that time at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and has touched a lot of student writers from that vantage point. Wonderful literary resource, a warm, wonderful person, great friend to poetry and the arts. Great pleasure to bring up here Howard Schwartz.
Thanks to Don Finkel for saving us in the nick of time here. And I put together I decided I was going to put together a selected poems. So I settled on the number 100 poems and picked about 75 from the first three books and 25 new ones. The overall title is Signs of the Lost Tribe. There's a Jewish, an old Jewish legend that 10 of the lost tribes disappeared. Actually, this happened historically. When the Jews were conquered, the 10 tribes in the north of what they call Judea, literally vanished. So ever since then, there have been all these theories about who they are, that they are the Chinese, are the Japanese, are they in India. And of course, the tribe of Dan is how the Ethiopian Jews identified themselves. And on that basis, they were brought into Israel as Jews. No one actually, though, has seen any sign of these tribes for the last 2,000 years until one of them turned up living in my house. Signs of the Lost Tribe. One day, I found the first sign. Old boxes stacked in the attic in a room I had never entered. After that, I found the signs everywhere, in every drawer I opened. on every doorpost I passed, when I lay down and when I rose up. Somehow, one of the 10 lost tribes had wandered out of the desert, and all of them were living in my house. Since then, I have become accustomed to their ways. Of course, I never acknowledge their presence. Who knows what they would do if their secret were known? They have traveled in exile ever since they were born, following the path of the Exodus wherever it leads them. Somehow, they still fulfill their rituals, carved out of so many years of wandering, blessing the moon at night, counting the stars, casting their sins into the waters. During the day, they search everywhere for the land that has been lost. At night, they hide from the unsuspecting, in closets filled with invisible families, in drawers crowded with sorrows, on shelves full of their sad songs. They even inhabit my dreams. There, above all, they are at home. This next one is a poem about forgetting. It's called Relearning the Alphabet. Somehow, I forgot everything, even the alphabet. I could not remember the name of a single letter. I tried to remember something, the shape of the moon, the sound of the wind in the leaves, the way a tree breathes in the dark. Letter by letter, I recovered the alphabet of creation. And when I looked down, a parchment of memories unrolled before me, and I began to read. I have a friend in Israel whose name is Yitzhak Greenfield. He's an artist. And I went to visit him one day. He lives in Ein Kerem, a little Arab village, or formerly Arab village, outside of Jerusalem. And he has a beautiful house, sort of domed house. And I came in, and he showed me one of his recent works, which looked exactly like a stone. I said, well, where did you get that from? He said, well, I got that from the wall, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, you know, the Western Wall. I said, well, how did you do that? They didn't let you go up there and, you know, do a rubbing at the wall. He said, no, he said, I snuck up at midnight when nobody was around, and while one of my friends stood guard, I ran to the wall and I did the rubbing. So afterwards, I thought about that, and I liked that idea of the wall rubbing, and ended up with this poem called A Wall Rubbing. Late at night, when no one else was nearby, we reached the wall. There, while you stood guard, I held this page against the stone and began to rub. Soon, dark letters began to emerge that slowly formed themselves into words. I tried to decipher them, but there was not enough light. When the rubbing was finished, we hurried home to read what was written there, but the words, like tears, were mute, and all we could discover in the outline of that ancient stone was a long silence. I've been keeping track of my dreams since about 1965. I have now a huge file on my computer, about 350K. And Don knows I'm not kidding. And this particular poem is a tissue of actual dreams. It's called Sea of Dreams. All night, I drifted back and forth on the sea of dreams, drifting from one dream to the next, In one, I watched a child ride a horse in a circle. In another, I journeyed alone to a valley of snow. In one, my father whispered a tale of hidden treasure. In another, we were traveling together in a foreign land. In one, I explored a cave at the bottom of a canyon. In another, I lowered myself into a well. Before waking, I poured a glass for everyone from a clear pitcher in which my dreams had been preserved. My wife and I and our family were at a camp in Wisconsin last summer. And at one point at breakfast, there was a visitor. A guy came, and he just happened to be sitting across the table from me, so I started talking to him, and turned out that he was a jeweler. And I told him my father was a jeweler. And, you know, we immediately had some kind of understanding that you can only have among the families of jewelers. And we had a very nice discussion. And one interesting point is that we were on the exact opposite side of the political spectrum. But nevertheless, we got along beautifully. And as he left, I said to him, I smiled, I said, well, we belong to the tribe of the jewelers. And then I walked back up to my cabin, and I thought about that, and I wrote this poem about my father. The tribe of the jewelers. A glowing jewel, like a lodestar, still guides them through the desert. While others see a landscape of rocks and sand stretching before them, they perceive the jewel concealed in every rock like a hidden sun. In their hands, the layers of the past peel away like the skin of an orange, revealing the precious core within. The secrets of the jewelers are passed down from father to son. How to distinguish what is precious from what is not. How to cut away what is not needed. How to set free all the hidden faces. This is my tribe. I can still see my father bent over a table, peering into the eye of the jewel, searching for the mysteries within. As I bend over this page and whisper the silent prayer of the jewelers, I hear my father whispering my name. These have all been recent poems. Here's one more of these recent ones. It's called A Shelter of Stars. We live in a shelter of stars. Our breath, only one of many winds set free in this place. We live in a shelter of branches, the roof, a firmament of stars. The cellar, a dark sea. We live in a shelter of song, a tabernacle of peace, our breath as fragile and wild as any wind. I'm going to read a few older ones, and then I'll finish with a few new ones. A while back, I wrote a poem and decided to dedicate it to Don Finkel, who was really my only, the only teacher that counted, as far as I'm concerned, back in my WashU days. And really, the greatest teacher you can imagine. And this poem is called The Black Dolphin, dedicated to Don. There is a black dolphin swimming in the same waters with us. If you submerge, you will hear its song rising up from within. Yes, the dolphin is diving below. Even now, it is searching in the deep for new songs, each one another pearl recovered from the waters of oblivion. What other purpose do we serve but to build a barrier against eternity, a fragile coral reef of song? I'm very interested in rabbinic legends, and I've written a number of poems based on them. They're little jewels that you can take and really develop nicely, but only one time did I actually make up a rabbinic legend that didn't exist, and that's this one, which is called Our Angels. Our angels spend much of their time sleeping. In their dreams, they tear down the new houses by the sea and build old ones in their place. No matter how long they may sleep, 100, 200 years, 10 centuries is not too much. The first to wake up takes the torch that has been handed down, adds a drop of oil to the lamp, blesses the eternal light, and then recalls the name of every other angel, and one by one, as they are remembered, they wake up. For them, as for us, there is nothing more beautiful than memory. This next poem is a quite old one. I think it goes back to, my God, something like 1972. I was in Israel for a few months, and I had this incredible series of dreams about women. I dreamed that a woman wanted to give birth, but there was some kind of obstacle that was preventing her. And I dreamed that a beautiful poet from South America came to my door, and I wouldn't let her in. And I dreamed that a young girl came with a ribbon marking a place in the Bible that she wanted me to read, but I refused to read it. And I knew that something was going wrong. And I was also having a period of having difficulty writing. And so I decided to try to write a poem that somehow contained the situation. And it was an important poem for me because it was the first of what I would call a muse poem. And I thought a while about what I would title it, and I titled it Sarah, which at that time I had in mind the biblical figure, who, by the way, is supposed to have been a great prophetess, but that seemed like the right name for my muse, at least at that point. Then I got stuck on this poem, and I didn't finish it for about 6 months. So this whole period of being stuck really lasted quite a while. But in the end, I did, and this is the poem. Sarah. She prays like the water, waiting as a wave to be formed. Somewhere in the highest branches, she restores herself in silence. Spirit, voice, not yet a word. She enters where the moons change and shows me a door standing open, a star taking root in the branches of a tree. Like a singer surrendering her voice, she offers me the question in her hand. What I had to give her is gone. There were a whole series of these muse poems. I'll read you just one more of them. This one really did grow out of reading a midrash. That's a rabbinic legend. There's a midrash where if you remember anything of the genealogy of Genesis, where they talk about Abraham and Sarah, they mention Sarah's family, and they mention a figure whose name is Isca. Now, if you can read this 100 times in the Bible, and you still won't be able to figure out how this Isca is related to Sarah. It's that complex and obscure. But one of the rabbis in the Talmud, which, you know, comes later, from around the 5th century, said that Isca was Sarah when Sarah became a prophetess. In other words, when she became a prophetess, she sort of changed personalities and became Isca. And that at least solved the problem. And I was very taken with the idea that this Isca was sort of the muse side of Sarah, and wrote this poem, Isca. She is the dark sister, standing in the shadow of the cave, who peers into the bonfire that is burning within. Sometimes she accompanies you with her instrument. Sometimes she lets you pray with her voice, or share the sound of her breathing, or even her song. This time, she lets you read your lifeline as if the words were already written. If only you would kneel by the fire, she whispers, you would understand why no water can extinguish this flame, why all the logs burst into buds and all the kinds of wood put forth fruit. I'm, as you may have figured out from the computer file of my dreams, I'm sort of a computer freak. And at one point, now it's already archaic, but I had a program called Word Freak, which was for word frequency. And you could run it on a file, and it would tell you how many times you used every word in the file. And I thought, God, I'll run it on my dream journal. So I did. And after you eliminated the words, you know, like the or a or he or she, and, you know, the obvious ones that you would expect, the word that was repeated most often, believe it or not, and I couldn't believe it, was salt. So I thought to myself, my God, what am I dreaming about salt for, you know? So I then did the logical thing that you can do with a computer, which is to do a search and to find, you know, where salt appeared in my dream journal. And I found this dream that I didn't remember writing. I must have written it, you know, got up, this is what happens. I get up at 3 a.m., stagger to the computer, type in the dream, and go back to sleep. And then I don't look at it for months, and I don't even remember dreaming it. So I looked at this dream about salt, and I wrote this poem, Salt. It's based on the dream, of course. Salt became so scarce, it was worth its weight in gold. Not only the shelves were empty, the salt had even vanished from the sea. What little was left, we hoarded. Too soon, even the hoards were empty. We dug in the earth everywhere, searching for salt, but it had all vanished. Salt was more precious than the veins in which it flowed. They were willing to kill for it. I have a little salt left. I'm afraid they will try to take it away. You've heard of the Tower of Babel, right? This is the Pit of Babel. I'm sure you've all been there. In your wanderings, you may have stumbled on the Pit of Babel, the mouth of the abyss, the fault line always ready to crack. Even now, you may be standing on it. This next poem had a sort of strange genesis, if you want to use that word. I had a terrible headache. This is not that unusual of an event, but in my case, I don't usually have migraine-type headaches, and I did. So I thought, well, I'll go swimming. Maybe that'll make it feel better. So I went swimming. I still had a headache. And I was getting dressed, and as I was getting dressed, all of a sudden, a poem came to me, every word, from beginning to end. This never happens to me, only to other lucky people. But in this case, it happened to me, but where was I going to write it? So I finished getting dressed as quickly as I could. I ran to the car, pulled out my notebook, and I wrote it down. Then I was thinking about this strange course of events. I had a headache, and then I had a poem. And I remembered this essay by Borges about Kubla Khan, the poem by Coleridge. In this, Borges discovers that sometime after Coleridge wrote Kubla Khan, there was a translation of an ancient Chinese history in which it was revealed that Kubla Khan built his palace after he had a dream. And as you know, Coleridge wrote his poem based on a dream. He was smoking opium and he fell asleep and he dreamed the poem. And, you know, he got the first 50 lines or so when the man from Porlock knocked on the door and distracted him, and that's all we've got. Just happens to be the greatest poem in English. And then Borges speculates. He says, what's real is the dream. The dream comes to an emperor, he builds a palace. He comes to a poet, he writes a poem. And he speculates sometime in the future, the dream will come to a musician, he'll write a symphony. So I thought, yes, what was real here was once a headache, and now it's a poem. I'm not sure it's the same exact transmutation, but the poem is called Courting Oblivion. Maybe you could see how it relates to the headache. Come here, she says, dancing on the edge, flicking one rose petal after another into the abyss. And every hour, you move one step closer, your eyes fixed on the breast that is almost torn free from her gown, averted from the other, dry as a raisin from which she suckles death. But which one will she offer? Come here, she whispers, crooking her finger, swaying her hips. Come closer. I'm going to end with a new little series of poems about a pretty obvious subject, and that is death. It's starting to haunt all around much more than it used to. Desert Song. A restless sea of sand erases our footprints. When nothing remains, the desert takes a long breath. This next one is based on a shamanistic exercise. It's called Contemplating One's Own Skeleton. I remember the sun till no voice remains to call the moon closer. I remember the moon till no waves remain to wash over sandstone. I remember the waves till no wind remains to scatter my ashes. I remember the wind till no sand remains to cover my bones. I remember my bones. I wrote this one in Israel. I was there a year ago, May, for a month. It's really not about Israel, although it may reflect the state of mind I was in at this point, but it's about that country, and it's called In That Country. In that country, there are no gates to enter or exit. No passports are required. No visas to be stamped. By the time you get there, it is already too late to turn back. In that country, there is no waiting for rooms, nor any rooms for waiting. despite all your plans, no one comes to welcome you. The phones are all silent. The traffic has come to a halt. In that country, there are no maps to read, no landmarks to guide you, no signposts, no stations on the way. Besides, all the roads lead to the same place. In that country, all the histories remain unwritten. All the books are blank. Not even the cycle of the seasons is known, or how long you must stay before you can set out for somewhere else. This is a little one called The Valley of the Shadow. One by one, we lose touch with each other as we descend into the dark. Floating like feathers into the valley, waiting to be gathered under the same shadow. This one was really weird. What happened here, it's all in the poem. It was a dream. I dreamed that I heard a chorus of angels. Okay. I woke up. I still heard them. Angel chorus. At the end of the dream, I heard a chorus of angels singing. When I opened my eyes, I still heard them. With dread, I sank back to sleep. Still, the chorus continued. Okay, this is the last poem. It's called The Last Sunset. I wrote it for my friend Gabriel Pryl. Pryl was an extremely strange case. He was a very great Hebrew poet who lived in Brooklyn. Actually, he lived in the Bronx. And he was basically unknown in this country except to a few people who knew his work in translation, but he was very famous in Israel. And every few years, they would manage to lure him there for a few months. And he died on a Friday night, middle of the night. They found him the next morning. The Last Sunset. Pryl always wrote about sunsets, and his last book was called, let's see if I can remember, it was called The Collector of Autumns. Surely Gabriel knew that he might be returning to Jerusalem to take his leave of this world. But how could he have known it would come on a Friday night in the arms of the Sabbath Queen? The collector of autumns and sunsets has himself been gathered in the Holy Land, in the city where his soul resided, even when his body was far away. If only he could tell us what the last sunset was like.